Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ambassador David Litt, who is Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Niamey. Is it Niamey?
It would be Niamey.
Niamey, who was Deputy Chief of Mission in Niamey, Niger, from 1990 to 1993, and a State Department political advisor to the U.S. Special Operations Command from 1998 to 2002. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Why is the United States in Niger Anyway? Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador David Litt.
Thank you very much, Ian. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much. And the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dunford, did a lengthy press conference the other day at which he himself expressed some frustration that the information about what really happened in Niger has been dripping in, and he didn't have a lot to say about, wasn't able to answer a lot of the questions. But at this point, what we're learning apparently is that there was two special operations teams very close by, the one that got ambushed suffered the casualties was one of them, but there was a more sort of deep cover JSOC team, Joint Special Operations Command team, that was also operating along with French, and that was a mixed special forces and intelligence civilian operation. And apparently they were able to, they had a drone with them, they were able to send the drone to see what happened with the other the group that were ambushed. But in general, let's start with the cooperation with the French, and they of course eventually sent in air cover, possibly and probably too late, but at least they had the military assets. So, what is the relationship with the French there, in as far as you know, in Niger?
As far as I know, we have had excellent cooperation with our French coalition partners, and they are predominant in Niger, as they are in Mali and other parts of West Africa where they were the former colonial power and retained strong interest in, influence, and ties with those countries at all levels. So there is a predominance of French influence in those countries, especially in Niger. I don't know precisely how close French special operations forces or French military, more broadly speaking, work with American military there, because I'm retired and I'm not part of the State Department. But I can easily imagine that our cooperation, as it has been across the board in many parts of the world, but in particular Francophone Africa, has been excellent.
Well, apparently what they were looking for, and I'm not sure about the Special Forces, Green Berets who were ambushed, but the JSOC team apparently, according to NBC News, were looking for Abu Walid al-Zawahiri, who apparently leads a sort of ISIS-affiliated jihadi group known as Al-Murabatun. Their leader apparently called the Marlborough Man has reportedly been killed many times. But there is that essentially what the strategy is here, to sort of find the jihadi leader? Because obviously the other team that were ambushed were set up by the local villagers. They were asking about somebody. I'm not sure whether it was this particular character, al-Zawahiri. But in general, is that our strategy so far, to just sort of go after the so-called high-value targets?
I couldn't really say. I don't really know. It has been in the past that high-value targets are important elements of any extremist groups in order to undermine those groups' ability to function across borders, through the internet, or however they communicate with each other, even by courier or whatever it may be. But I'm confident also that part of the operations of U.S. military, in particular special operations, is to improve the capacity of host nation forces to able to carry out military operations, design military operations, carry them out, because they are best informed and best able to do the kinds of operations in remote parts of the world that they know best. They speak the languages, they know the people, they can interact in villages and towns much more effectively than the United States can. But, of course, that in part, we do have U.S. military there for operations that that the commands, whether it's Africa Command or Special Operations Command, decide that we need American forces for.
But on the other side, arguably, that the fact that this whole area is racked with poverty, with weak governance, and with these insurgent movements, I mean, it does seem that the broad landscape is one that's a fairly fertile ground for recruiting jihadi, or whether it's al-Qaeda or ISIS.
This is the bottom line, absolutely right, that wherever governance is weak, wherever citizens don't feel that they have the that their government has their best interests at heart, or worse, are putting them at severe disadvantage, or through corruption, or other types of misgovernance, that is where extremist groups can best hide out, can best recruit, and get their point across to populations. Because after all, it is the populations in which they dwell that they can best develop their own kinds of legitimacy through their false promises and false hopes. So therefore, it is incumbent on other nations who assist Niger or Mali or Nigeria or others to assist in their building credibility, legitimacy, and sovereignty in parts of their country that otherwise might suffer from a lack of governance and those kinds of views from the population.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador David Litt, who was Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Niamey, Niger, from 1990 to 1993, and a State Department political advisor to U.S. Special Operations Command from 1998 to 2002. And he has an article in Foreign Policy, Why is the United States in Niger Anyway? Now, just looking at the map, of course, Niger is surrounded by a number of countries, Benin, Burkina Faso, Mali, Algeria to the north, Libya to the north, and then to the east, Chad, and then to the south, Nigeria. Nigeria, of course, is beset with Boko Haram, and I take it that there's been a spillover into Niger from Boko Haram, and the U.S., now that we've, after this loss of these special forces, these Green Berets, we've learned that actually the U.S. presence in Niger is one of the biggest in terms of military training assistance. But the Niger military is pretty weak, I understand. Conversely, the military in Chad apparently is much more trained and professional. But we've just put Chad on the sort of terrorist list, which has not exactly endeared them to us, has it?
Most likely not. I haven't heard direct responses out of I've not read any or heard any direct responses out of Chad, but I can imagine that they are probably just as bewildered as many observers of foreign policy are, why we should be targeting a country like Chad that is both poor, struggling to be a stable force in the region, and assisting its neighbors to deal more effectively with the extremist forces like, as you mentioned, Boko Haram and others that all of these countries potentially will suffer from. So Chad is one of the team. And whether I have never seen any credible motive for putting them on a list of countries who should not be eligible for visas for the United States. If there is an issue, as I have read, with paper, passport paper, or some other law enforcement issue, I'm sure we could deal with that in a proper way. But just to put them willy-nilly on the list doesn't seem to me to make much sense at all when we have larger issues at stake for U.S. national security interest in the region.
Well, the latest travel ban, of course, also put to North Korea, and there's not exactly a lot of travel between North Korea and the United States. North Korea was put on the list along with Venezuela, and a lot of critics of the administration think that that was simply a way to take the onus off the idea that it was a Muslim travel ban. But Chad, which you're puzzled about, I'm puzzled about, because obviously it's right in the middle of where, for example, Senator Lindsey Graham the other day seemed to think that this could be the next theater, and he even went so far as to say that the next 9/11 attack could come out of Central and West Africa. So what do you think of that warning?
I think we should, the United States should always be vigilant about parts of the world that extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State organization will try to insert themselves into in order to find a safe space for them to plan, rest, recuperate, recruit, and so on, as they have done in so many other parts of certainly of the Middle East and of Africa, but in other parts of the world as well. And I don't think we can do a very good job of predicting where the next location for insurgent extremists is likely to be, and it is for that reason that U.S. policy, in my view, is best served by having our diplomatic and development cadres work very diligently in countries that that exhibit local conflict, perhaps underneath the surface, help them to build capacity to deal with their own conflicts and to deal with economic and social development so that they will not become future havens for terrorists. It's that kind of foresight across the board that will help America be more safe, not just try to chase after extremists and only try to assist in countries that are already infected with extremism.
Well, in your article at Ambassador Litt at Foreign Policy, Why is the United States in Niger Anyway? You talk about the time that you were there in the early 1990s when the leader of Niger took an unusual political step for an African nation where he actually came to the U.S. and other embassies in Niamey asking for help to actually make his country more pluralistic, more democratic, more stable, etc. That's not the trend normally with the so-called strongman in Africa. How's it doing, to put it bluntly?
I think Niger is doing about as well as one can hope, given the dearth of resources and the weak infrastructure that Niger still suffers from. But is at least has developed some of the foundations for participatory democracy, that is to have citizens participate, citizens across the board participate in all areas of their lives, economic, social, and political, and to have built certain institutions that are relatively transparent. It is still very much of a tribal society. It still is a society that that suffers from a lack of resources, in natural resources, and has the bases for some accountability for those officials that transgress the rule of law or the expectations of the citizens for them to follow norms of the society. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, and it's this kind of experiment that requires constant assistance and vigilance by partners and donors of countries like Niger, to continually work with them according to plans that the Nigerian government itself wants to have, and consonant with listening to civil society. society so that if there are dissenting views, they can be heard, and that too is a critical part of society, as we're witnessing in places like Spain and elsewhere, the Kurdish populations of Iraq, for example. So it is that kind of constant assistance and vigilance from Niger's partners and collaborators in economic development that will help continue to push it up the ladder of human development.
But in general, in that part of the world and in much of the world, it seems it's easier to get hold of an AK-47 assault rifle than it is to get a job.
Yes, getting weapons is often a lot easier than getting a job, and being in a developing country, that's not the only place where that kind of phenomenon is present. But that is part of the institutional challenge for any government anywhere to provide gainful, useful, valuable employment for its citizens, to give them the kind of education that will ultimately lead to careers inside their own country, where they will not only grow themselves and provide for their families, but also help their communities, their provinces, and ultimately their nation to progress. It's a very complex, intertwined set of processes that just take a long, long time to develop. And how you eliminate guns, for example, the AK-47 that you rightly mentioned is ubiquitous. It's traded far too easily around the world, and that is an effort of law enforcement, of border protection forces, and the United States, for example, does provide assistance, or at least did in the past. I'm not sure what the situation is today. Provide assistance to certain nations in learning how better to protect their borders from illicit trafficking, whether it's of humans or arms or drugs or whatever that may be.
Well, just in closing, Ambassador David Litt, you mentioned Iraqi Kurdistan, which has suffered a great setback with the Iranian-backed Iraqi militias taking Kirkuk, which is the economic lifeline for the Kurdish Iraqi state, and now it's now not viable. It's surrounded by enemies, Iran and Turkey, and now Baghdad. And many analysts are suggesting that the U.S. wasn't sufficiently vigilant in watching the situation, because we're so understaffed, both on the National Security Council and at the State Department and in the Pentagon as well, that we weren't able to dissuade the Iraqis or the Kurds from this reckless vote of independence, which has created this blowback. That's just one of the many theaters where you keep hearing reports that we are suffering in terms of our ability to deal with these crises around the world. We don't have an ambassador in South Korea, for example, where there is a lot of tension with North Korea. We don't have, I believe, in West Africa, we don't have a Secretary of State for West Africa, and we certainly don't have anybody on the National Security Council with that portfolio. And you could go through a number of other regions of the world to find that we are just lacking in not being staffed up at DOD, at the NSC, and at the state.
I completely agree that the United States suffers tremendously in the execution and implementation of diplomacy when we are so thinly staffed at the middle management and senior levels as we are today. We have a lot of foreign service officers who are in acting positions, which is fine for foreign service officers, but you do need to have that connected flow of policy recommendations up and down, and more fluid implementation of our policy, not only up and down in the bureaucracy, but in and out of the United States, out to embassies, back from embassies into the Washington national security infrastructure. It is a situation that I believe should have been remedied certainly at the level of the leadership of our regional bureaus, that is the Assistant Secretary for Africa, the Assistant Secretary for the Near East, the Assistant Secretary for East Asia, and so on. Those positions are now just slowly being staffed, and there are a variety of reasons why that hasn't happened, which you could probably go into in a different session. But suffice it to say that the State Department must be fully staffed at a senior level in order to get the most out of our diplomatic service and to feed into the national security infrastructure. I would say that the Kurdish situation has its own dynamic and may or may not have been aided had we had people in place. That's another story that goes back to the days of the occupation, where Kurds, Shia and Sunni Arabs had the responsibility to make decisions according to the constitution about the distribution of and the authorities over the oil infrastructure, how decisions would be made, and so on, and the status of Kirkuk and land tenure, and all sorts of things that just had not been done, and we arrived at today in a state of affairs in which they really need to get back to making those decisions collaboratively among themselves for the benefit of Iraq.
Well, Ambassador Litt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador David Litt, who's a Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Niamey, Niger, from 1990 to 1993, and the State Department Political Advisor to the U.S. Special Operations Command from 1998 to 2002. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Why is the United States in Niger Anyway? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.